Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much, Amy and Annie, for inviting me to take part in this symposium. I'd also like to acknowledge David Zay, my partner in this research. Now, before I start, I should point out that although I am going to talk about sexual selection in the harlequin beetle, Acrocynus longimanus, the main focus of our research is actually the pseudoscorpion that utilizes this very striking cerambycid beetle as its dispersal agent. And I have to admit, I feel rather like a pseudoscorpion myself here today, riding on the backs of all you true cerambycid workers out there. Anyway, that being said, harlequin beetles are really spectacular cerambycids that range from southern Mexico down to northern Argentina. And they certainly rank among the charismatic megafauna of the insect world. Large males, in particular, are really impressive with their extremely elongated, hooked forelegs. And although males and females don't differ in body size, as measured by elytra length, there's marked sexual dimorphism in foreleg length, as you can see from this bottom histogram. Male foreleg length can reach almost 150 millimeters, which is nearly twice that of females of comparable body size. And this sexual dimorphism results primarily from very strong positive allometry in males. Male forelegs lengthen disproportionately with increasing body size, and that's not the case in females here. The FG and Pan here refer to French Guiana and Panama, and we found no significant geographic variation in either allometry or extent of sexual dimorphism in these two widely separated populations. Now, here's the harlequin beetle riding pseudoscorpion called Lucernes scorpioides, and it's also highly sexually dimorphic. Males have enlarged pedipalps, the appendages important in combat. They have enlarged chelae, or hands, and a pronounced bump on the tibia that's lacking in females. Now, both the pseudoscorpion and the harlequin beetle were named by Linnaeus back in the 18th century, and it's been known for a really long time that if you prize open the elytra of a harlequin beetle, you're likely to find at least one pseudoscorpion installed on its abdomen. But quite what the pseudoscorpions were doing there was something of a mystery. And one popular ecology textbook, which I'm not going to name, until recently had this pseudoscorpion living exclusively on harlequin beetles, and I quote, nowhere else on Earth. Well, that's not the case, because the primary habitat of Cordylocernes scorpioides is, in fact, decaying trees in the families Myraceae and Apocynaceae, like this dead standing ficus in the lowland rainforests of central Panama. Now, dispersal between these rich but very patchily distributed and ephemeral habitats is a major challenge for a small flightless arthropod like a pseudoscorpion. And Cordylocernes scorpioides solved this problem by hitchhiking on harlequin beetles that use these same decaying trees for mating, overposition, and larval development. When new harlequin beetles eclose from their pupal chambers in old exhausted trees, the pseudoscorpions climb on board, spin themselves silken safety harnesses, and settle in for the beetle's maiden flight in search of overposition sites and females, or and mates rather. Now, harlequin beetle females oviposit only on newly dead and dying trees, and this ensures that the pseudoscorpions are carried to a prime new habitat. So the harlequin beetle provides the pseudoscorpion with what amounts to a jumbo jet transport service. And this is a really great solution to the problem of dispersal. But it's not the end of the story, because beetle abdomens are a strategic site for pseudoscorpion males to intercept and inseminate dispersing females. So, whereas females disembark relatively rapidly, the males instead fight to stay on the beetle. Here's a female rappelling down a silken thread, which you may just be able to make out. She's colonizing a new tree while two males fight on the beetle. Now, small males get forced off by larger rivals, so that after its maiden flight, a harlequin beetle typically carries a single large male defending a mobile mating territory on its abdomen. Here's one of those large males mating with a female on the beetle's abdomen. Now, as the beetle continues its search for oviposition sites and mates, subelytral space remains a really dynamic site for male competition. Females or challenging males may transfer onto the beetle from other beetles. The resident male may disembark to reconnoitre other beetles. And new dispersing individuals may come on board the beetle when it visits trees that are a mosaic of living and necrotic tissue. Now, this dispersal phase on beetles can be viewed as an episode of sexual selection, with two multiplicative components to male reproductive success. A male first has to succeed in monopolizing a beetle's abdomen. Here are two males fighting for control of the beetle. And he then has to fertilize the eggs of females passing through his territory. Now, to look at the first component of male reproductive success, we compared the size of beetle-riding males and males randomly sampled from pre-dispersal tree populations. And we found that competition to monopolize beetle abdomens eliminates small males, thereby shifting the arena for subsequent competition to the upper end of the source tree's phenotypic distribution. For example, for the highly exaggerated male trait tibia depth, the mean value for beetle-riding males was more than a standard deviation unit greater than the mean for males sampled from trees. And this difference provides an estimate of the first component of sexual selection in the beetle environment. These are data from Panama, by the way, and here are comparable data from French Guiana. Now, to examine whether this intense size-based competition to monopolize beetle abdomens translates into fertilization success, we carried out a paternity assignment study in which we collected males and females at the end of dispersal, reared the female's offspring in the lab, and then used single locus mini satellite markers to assign paternity. Here's one of the gels from that study, a female, M for mother, two putative sires, and 12 of the female's offspring. Now, not surprisingly, one or other of the female's two alleles is present in each of the offspring. And all the non-maternal alleles, this allele here and this lower molecular weight allele at the bottom here, can be traced to male B in this case. Now this paternity assignment study showed that it's the largest of these large beetle-riding males that achieve the highest fertilization success. Mean tibia depth increased a further 0.6 of a standard deviation unit. And so taken together, these results demonstrate that Caudalocerne scorpioides experiences really intense sexual selection for large male size and fighting ability during dispersal on harlequin beetles. And as we'll see in a moment, the same is true for the harlequin beetles themselves. Now, the trees used by Acrocynus longimanus produce this really milky, viscous sap. And when a tree falls, like this Ficus insipida, that very obligingly fell alongside a trail in the Sobirinha National Park in Panama, it spews out large quantities of this really pungent sap, which draws in the harlequin beetles. Males tend to arrive first, and they fight for control of oviposition sites. A contest begins when two males approach one another, twisting their heads from side to side and waving their antennae. They meet head on with their forelegs outstretched, apparently sizing each other up. The contest can end at this point with one male beating a retreat, or it can escalate into outright aggression involving head-butting and biting. Harlequin beetles have really powerful mandibles, as David and I both know from very painful experience. And males can inflict really quite serious injuries on each other. We've examined more than 90 males in the field, and over 10% of them had missing antennal or foreleg segments that were almost certainly severed by opponents during fights. Now, the males then move apart in opposite directions until each male has a foreleg hooked around the thorax of his opponent. And this is where the Coleopteran jiu-jitsu comes into play. And it's really dramatic and extremely exciting to watch. The males rear up on their hind legs and then lunge forward rapidly using their forelegs like hooked levers to try and toss the opponent. There can be repeated bouts of head-butting, biting, and tossing attempts until eventually one male is either flipped over on his back, like this male, or gets tossed right off the tree. It's really exciting. Anyway, to quantify the relationship between male size and fighting success, we staged fights between males. For each contest, we placed two males equidistant from a female on a tree, observed the interactions, and recorded fight duration. Now, not surprisingly, we found that relative size, that is, size difference between the two opponents, had a significant effect on fight outcome and fight duration. Winners were significantly larger than losers for all traits, particularly femur length and tibia length. Fight duration ranged from 34 minutes down to just 20 seconds and decreased as size difference between the two opponents increased. In other words, closely matched males fought for longer. Now, interestingly, absolute size also had an effect. When we held size difference constant by carrying out a multiple regression of fight duration on size difference and on the absolute size of the smaller combatant, fight duration was positively correlated with size. Even if small males were closely matched in size, they didn't engage in the protracted combat typical of large males. And our field observations suggest that rather than fighting, what small males do is hang out in locations on the periphery of a fallen tree, and then engage in the sneak strategy of trying to intercept and mate with females as soon as they arrive at a tree. And we can see additional evidence for those alternative male strategies if we look at the relationship between tibia morphology and size. As you can see from this graph, there's a very strong positive relationship between the extent of curvature of the angle at the distal end of the tibia and elytra length. So whereas those large males have the really hooked forelegs needed for tossing opponents, small males down here have essentially straight tibia like females. Now, females tend to come in at dusk for mating and overposition. Copulation lasts between 3 and 5 minutes, and the female then chews a hole through the bark while the male stands guard, straddling the female with his forelegs. This excavation is really arduous business that can take the female up to an hour. Anyway, eventually, when she's finished, the pair rotate, the female overposits into the hole, and copulation resumes. This cycle of copulation, excavation, and overposition is repeated over and over again, leaving a characteristic line of holes in the bark. Now, to assess the relationship between male size and mating success, we monitored the number of females with which each male mated. If females were present on a tree, we gave males a score of 1 if they were paired with a female, and 0 if they were unpaired. And we found that there was a positive relationship between mating success and size across all traits. Now, unfortunately, because traits were highly intercorrelated, it wasn't possible to identify the direct target of sexual selection. But it seems likely that effective use of those very elongated forelegs requires a corresponding increase in body size, so that sexual selection for increase in foreleg length in Acrocynus longimanus is probably masked by selection to maintain an integrated male phenotype. Now, our results demonstrate that under the relatively high density conditions of newly fallen trees, sexual selection in the harlequin beetle strongly favors large male size and fighting ability. But it's important to bear in mind here that harlequin beetles also mate up in the canopy on dying sections of living trees. In this environment, large male size may not have the same high payoff, and the greater mobility of small males could well give them an advantage in terms of their ability to locate overposition sites and females more quickly than the more heavily encumbered large males. Now, to conclude, I'm going to switch from the harlequin beetle adults to their somewhat less attractive-looking larvae, which, as you can see, grow to quite a considerable size. Something of an exaggeration, I admit, but not too much. Anyway, whereas it's the adults that transport the pseudoscorpions to newly dead and dying trees, it's the larvae that then transform these trees into a prime habitat for pseudoscorpion reproduction and population growth. They excavate extensive galleries under the bark, and they chew large tunnels into the trunk, loosening up the bark and generating huge quantities of frass. Now, this is an ideal habitat not just for Cordylicernes scorpioides, but for literally hundreds of other species as well. Stradiomyid flies, staphylinid beetles, nereid flies, pantophthalmid flies, brentid weevils, click beetles, cockroaches, amblypygids, true scorpions, even land crabs. They all utilize these decaying trees. And decaying ficus trees in particular are a real paradise for entomologists. At the height of their productivity, they just seem to teem with with activity. And one avenue of research that we'd really like to pursue in the future is the role that Acrocynus longimanus plays as a keystone species for this large and extremely diverse community of neotropical terrestrial arthropods that inhabits these decaying trees. Thank you. Are there any questions? Question? Yeah?
Do other large cerevisids ever harbor
Amy asked whether there are other large cerambycids that carry pseudoscorpions. Well, actually, veretic dispersal by attachment to the legs of flies is most common. But there are cases, for example, Lustrocernes pseudoscorpions are known or have been found on large beetles like Stenodontes and Macrodontia. And outside of the cerambycid, I think there are reports of Cheliferid and Atemnid pseudoscorpions being found on scarab beetles. Now, whether or not these beetles lend themselves to being exploited as mobile mating territories as well isn't known. And certainly the shape and size of a beetle's abdomen can be a limiting factor in whether it's appropriate as a mating territory. And even in harlequin beetles, we know from mark and recapture experiments where we allowed different combinations of male and female pseudoscorpions to board harlequin beetles in the lab and then released the beetles onto trees and recaptured them later to census the pseudoscorpions still present, we found that pseudoscorpion males don't remain on small beetles, suggesting that a beetle's abdomen has to be a certain size to be any good as a mating territory. Yeah? There aren't really any interactions. It's likely not to be very harmful for the beetle under most situations, except during its maiden flight when beetles can carry a large number of pseudoscorpions on their abdomen. I think our record was 30 pseudoscorpions all crammed onto the abdomen of a beetle, and I think there are records in the literature of up to 40 or more on beetle's abdomen. And in that situation, a newly closed beetle trying to take off laden with that number of pseudoscorpions is probably pretty cumbersome. But whether or not, and also I think it's been suggested that the pseudoscorpions may benefit the harlequin beetle because they feed on mites that are also phoretic on the beetle, but whether they do that in sufficient numbers to really be a major benefit is not known. Sorry, can you?
Is there any indication of predation of the eggs of the harlequin beetle by the pseudoscorpion?
No, I haven't I'm not aware of any evidence of that. No, I don't think so. Okay, thank you. Oh, I'll let you get past it.
So,
So I really want to thank everyone for coming and attending our first annual Cerambycid meeting symposium. So I want to have this opportunity now to sort of talk about what, like, okay, for example, it would be nice, like, I was wondering, first of all, does anyone have any announcements? Okay, I guess not. I thought what we might do is we could, this is going to sound like very elementary school student, but maybe we could, the people who are working on Cerambycid or interested in Cerambycids, you could, like, raise your hand and say, I am Annie Ray and I study whatever, or you would obviously say, and then maybe we could put faces to names in some of these cases, because I know that there's some new people around. Would that be, does that make you want to die? Does that make, or maybe not. Yeah, exactly. Oh, and we're going to do this next year. And if you would like to talk about Cerambycid beetles next year at the meeting, send me an email, because I would like to hear from you. I would like to invite you to give a talk. So, okay. Is that dumb? Okay. Who studies Cerambycids? Okay. This is Kapil, right? Go ahead. You can introduce yourself. Yes, you heard it right. He's working on the acanthocyanines. Send that man your material. Okay, is there any, okay, who else is it? Who else raised their hand? Stand up and say who you are. He's really good at Cerambycids, so everyone should talk to him later. Who else? Well, our speakers obviously do. Was there any non-speaker that works on Cerambycids? This is Fred Skillman. I'll introduce you. Fred's a very good, is an excellent collector. And he's an aficionado of collecting. And, of course, I think a lot of you know Gino Nerns. Raise your hand. And then Tracy Grismala, who studies Elytroleptis and who's going to keep studying Elytroleptis. And then, do we have anybody else? Peter Regal in the back row is in the Hanks lab, and he works on natural enemies of Cerambycid beetles. Did I miss anybody? Okay. So, who needs, Duane, did you want to talk a little bit about specimens? I know that you...
Yeah, well, I think one of the useful things to do, perhaps, because I've already impressed that you're obviously working on Cerambycid biological that you know about, before we meet, maybe next, unless there's something else on the books, I would like to get everyone together that's even just interested in the phylogeny of Cerambycids. You don't even have to be a molecular person, because of course we all need material and specimens to work with. I also would like to try to encourage folks to be working at least cooperatively to some extent. So I would love to do that. I would love to take even just 5 minutes of your time to get a quick overview of what you're doing. You can share that and kinds of things that you need for your work, and also maybe perhaps talk about possibilities for working together. That's something I'd like to do. So before we meet, anyone else wants to cover here, let's plan just, I'll grab a spot, let's stay up in the front corner there, and sit down and talk for a few minutes.
So there's one other thing that I wanted, Ian wants to talk about the newsletter. Ian's going to talk about the newsletter. So I'm not going to, yeah.
Yeah, well, we're trying to put together the Cerambycid newsletter, so would just go out generally to the Cerambycid community all over the world. And, this Cerambycid community has a listserv, Cerambics. It's, it doesn't get used a whole lot. So, but anyway, the bottom line is not to go on and on, but if you were trying to get a maiden issue together and hopefully get something regular going, like quarterly or maybe less, I don't know, think after that, after people all over the world, maybe that's kind of wishful thinking. I don't know. After a certain number of people see the newsletters, the articles, and you know, they will be hopefully they will want to contribute. So, but in the meantime, if there's folks out here, especially in the audience here, that are interested in helping contributing articles, especially the first few issues, and certainly the other ones as well, that would be absolutely excellent because we're trying to put one together. It was my hope to have a nice big stack of them here today to hand out to everyone attending this symposium, but it didn't happen for myself. I wasn't able to kind of get it together. So anyway, but that's in the future. So if you're interested in contributing an article, definitely let me know. I believe we agreed that it doesn't even have to be in English. We're taking other. It's a worldwide newsletter, so any language. So anyway.
What's your target publication date here?
What's my target publication? Oh, man. Yeah, 2000. Let's just say this. I would like to get the first issue out before... you know, I don't really know. Probably like in the next 4 months, let's just say that.
Ben, did you have a question?
Let's just ask. So this would be distributed by the web?
This newsletter would be, we're thinking of not do like a paper version of it, just have it, you know, a PDF, web version of this newsletter, be up on a website. This would basically be a lot like other co-author family have these newsletters. It would be for, San Francisco really don't have them, so it would be, I think it's an excellent opportunity. I mean, I don't really have to talk too much about this, but for us to kind of communicate different research trips that we go on, maybe kind of short updates of the research that we're doing, all that kind of stuff. So anyway. Contact me if you're interested. Really appreciate it.
I think that's everything. I don't feel like we need to excessively discuss it. Are there any other concerns? Have I missed something? Are you going to walk away thinking, geez, I really wish Andy would have done whatever? No? Okay. All right, well, thank you again, everyone. Thank you so much. I thought this was really awesome, and I appreciate your attendance, and let's do this again next year. Okay.